Hello, I'm Paul Greatrex, and this episode of the podcast sees a second discussion with Lee Sanders, Registrar and Secretary and Chief Operating Officer at the University of Birmingham. This time, we're talking about a long-standing collaboration between Swedish and UK registrars, generations of whom have been meeting at a biennial seminar which has been running since 1984. Lee and I both joined the group in 2011, having been tapped on the shoulder for the Cardiff conference, and since then have experienced a series of successful events where registrars from both countries have shared information on similar challenges faced. We note the impressive standard of English of Swedish colleagues and the commonalities and differences of the two national systems, as well as the political context in which we're operating. Topics for consideration at seminars over the years have ranged from Brexit and COVID impacts to international research security and student involvement in governance. Lee and I also discuss some of the big differences in Sweden which have been explored, including the way in which higher education capital funding differs and the fact that there is a national student record system in Sweden called LADOC. In addition to tours and excursions, there is a social element to the seminar, which also involves a singing competition of dubious quality. It's a brief run-through of the many virtues of a really distinctive collaborative arrangement which has been operating successfully for over 40 years now. I do hope you enjoy the recording. Welcome everyone to the latest episode of University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff. And for the second time, it's my huge privilege to introduce Lee Sanders, who's Registrar and Secretary and probably other things at the University of Birmingham. So hello, Lee, again.
Hello, Paul, and thanks very much for inviting me back. I obviously didn't say anything last time that drove you away. So yeah, and how are you? You all right?
I'm doing very well, thank you, in these challenging times. Now, what we thought it would be nice to talk about, because last time we spoke, which was a few years ago, we were talking very much about higher education in the UK. But you and I have both been involved for quite a few years with a really distinctive partnership with our counterparts in Sweden, which is a biennial event where Swedish and UK registrars get together to talk about issues of common concern, but also to learn from each other and, you know, find areas for mutual interest and collaboration. And it's a really fascinating program to be part of, isn't it?
Completely, yes. And I joined around the same time as you did, about 2011. But actually, when we were both thinking about this discussion, we were looking back at it, and I think it's been going for about 40 years, hasn't it? It's a really long-standing, enduring and successful collaboration.
Yeah. And there was a brief kind of history of the programme written about a decade ago now, which sought to try and capture some of the origins of it, which is all we've got to go on, because, as you say, it goes back to, I think, 1984 was the first formal one. Obviously, long we were still at school. Well, not quite, but you know what I mean. We're a lot younger. Anyway.
Just at university, I think.
indeed. But so it's got a long history, and I think it started at the instigation of the Swedes, I think, who were looking to look outside the country and looking to the UK to find ways to learn. And it was a kind of funded program, I think, wasn't it, in the first instance?
It was, and it started to begin with between Scotland and Sweden.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Not the whole of the UK. I think the original partnership was the Scots with the Swedes. And I think part of the explanation for that is the sort of history and affinity between Scotland and Nordic countries. And I think that's talked about, isn't it, in the report. But as you say, I think the initiative came from the Swedes, who were interested in learning from other higher education sectors at the time, and they observed what was going on in the UK in the 1980s, and so I think they connected with their counterparts in Scotland, and it took off from there.
And their higher education association, or whatever it was called, Swedish conference or something, put a bit of money into it, which, you know, kind of pump primed the whole event for quite a few years, I think. And it was just bringing together people to talk about higher education and learn from each other. And it's just gone on from there. And every time they've had it, they've said, should we do this again? And every time everyone said, yes, we must do it again.
Yes, exactly. And I think we should say up front, as with most successful networks, people like each other, they get on well, and they socialize well. There's a strong, you know, professional and working element to it, which I'm sure we'll get onto in this discussion. But also there's an important social element to it as well, which helps with keeping it going and making people motivated to want to not just go back to the seminars and the conferences, the formal events, but actually stay in touch with each other, set up bilateral relationships, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the thing that struck me in that first event and all the subsequent ones, in fact, so that first one you mentioned, 2011, was I think in Cardiff. I can remember being slightly disappointed it wasn't in Sweden. But, you know, that persuaded me that it was worth sticking with it for the next time. But was just how nice all the Swedish colleagues were. They were just genuinely lovely people.
They were, yeah, completely lovely people, very welcoming. We should say, actually, that there's a sort of mystery as to how you get invited to join. And the report refers to the, quote, tap on the shoulder. Is it worth just saying a bit about that?
Because from a Swedish perspective, it's a much smaller HE system, and they haven't got that many people to choose from. So they're essentially self-selecting. So it's the people who are free and able and want to come, who are basically all the Swedish registrars. So there isn't a huge pool there. But with our group, it has been the kind of tap on the shoulder thing. And you and I were both tapped on the shoulder around the same time. And I still really don't know why.
Yes, exactly. Well, you and me. There's an organising group, isn't there? That you know, there's a couple of registrars or Swedish title university directors, the equivalent, that sort of organise it and you know, hand the baton on from generation to generation. And I think it is they that think carefully about the makeup of the group and so on, and the mix of institutions, because it's a mix of across the UK now, isn't it, of big and small and different institutions, which
there's
I still think
a good,
is good.
Still a good Scottish representation in there, though, as befits the history of the organisation as well. But you're right. I mean, it's a good. I mean, that's what I think. You know, and. Again, not really sure why we were chosen, but there was a sense in which they were trying to get an element of diversity within the group. Yeah. And I certainly got the impression from the early days, essentially it was, you know, it was men of a certain age, because that was the makeup of British registrars at the time. Yes. And it has evolved to a point now, fortunately, where it's a much more balanced grouping, which is good to see.
Much more diverse group. I completely agree with you about that. The other thing that reading the report and reflecting on this came to the fore to me is why it's been so enduring. I mean, is it worth just sort of discussing that, about what are the characteristics of this? We should say this this seminar, this conference. As you said, happens every 2 years, and we alternate between the two countries, and we put a program together of we can talk perhaps in a bit about the topics, but those topics have evolved over the years. But there's a sort of set of characteristics that I think make this an enduring collaboration, which I don't know about you, but it made me think perhaps these are worth reflecting on for other forms of international networks, and what makes them successful, whether there's sort of a set up with a lot of enthusiasm and then peter out.
Well, we talked about the membership thing, right? And there is turnover every year. So there's always a few new people in there, but there's always continuity as well. So you know that if you've gone to more than one, you're going to meet some people that you've met before, and you're going to be able to kind of continue those relationships, which I think that kind of rolling continuity is a really important kind of cornerstone of the operation. And there's a sense in which we are all of, you know, we share a similar set of issues and challenges and experiences. And and actually those kind of peer engagements are incredibly valuable for kind of confidential and frank discussions. And
completely right. There's a there's an element of mutual support, isn't there? And and you know, I don't know, mentorship or, you know, seeking advice and guidance, I think, that keeps it going. We're all in the same boat facing the same issues. And I think the one obvious thing that people point to, and the report names this, is language. The Swedes are brilliant at English. Most of them speak exceptionally good English, although they are very you know, they you know, they're not boastful at all about it. Some of them think their English is not great, but I you know, it is phenomenally good, isn't it? Certainly a lot better than my Swedish.
Oh, I know. I mean, and they are actually really quite anxious about it quite a lot of the time, but you know, their English is excellent, both written and verbal. I mean, it is you know, frankly embarrassing how good they are, and that, you know, they contribute at a level that you would just, you know, be completely confident that they could carry off anything in a UKHE context should they decide to work in this country as well. I mean, it's hugely impressive.
It is. And I also think they are very aware of and watch closely developments in UK higher education. I think the Swedish system tends to anyway, and they as individuals are very mindful of it. So not only are they incredibly competent in English, but actually they are They have a really good understanding of some of the basics of UK higher education. And I think that's important. The other thing is commitment. I've always thought that the group, I mean, part of the deal is for being part of it is you've got to join in, you've got to show up, and you've got to contribute to the sessions. You've got to give in to the session as much as you take out of it. And I think that's helped with the continuity, that the people who remain in it are very committed.
Undoubtedly, everyone makes the effort. And as you say, everyone contributes to the sessions as well. And those sessions, I mean, they do change over the years, but we always have a, you know, a kind of state of the nation from each other's perspective, which I think is a really important kind of primer at the beginning of each conference to get people on the same page about what the developments have been, you know, over the past couple of years, and as a reminder of some of the structural differences, which I always find invaluable, because I always find, you know, forget some of the details about the Swedish system, but it's always a really, really helpful reminder. It's a really good baseline for the discussions over the subsequent couple of days.
Yeah, agree with that. So, you know, and actually the commonality of those problems and the learning from each other's experience is something that's very noticeable over the years, and also is cited in the report that we were talking about as another characteristic of what makes it enduring. The fact that, you know, people are committed and want to come because the topics are interesting, and you're talking with peers about in issues that may have some local nuance in Sweden compared with Scotland, compared with England, but nonetheless we can all recognize and all engage with. I mean, you know, take for example one of the big topics we've just been grappling with at the conference that we had last at Southampton, which was AI, the implications in all shapes and forms for AI on the future of higher education, just as one example. I also think the caliber of the participants makes a big difference. You know, there's some great, great colleagues, always worth catching up with and listening to, and some great guest speakers as well. It's quite common, isn't it, for the host organisation to involve guest speakers, both from elsewhere within their university, but also from outside the university. And we've had some really interesting contributions from external speakers as well, which is always a good draw.
Definitely. On the caliber point, I think one of the interesting things about the Swedish system is that there's more fluidity or transfer between government agencies and university directors, because they are, you know, much more like public appointments than they are in the UK, where it's individual universities appointed. So you get people moving into government and then back into the university sector. So you get a lot more interesting perspectives, because, you know, the universities are much closer to government in Sweden than they are in the UK, or rather in England. Of course, in Scotland, the situation is arguably a lot closer, again, to Sweden, because government is much closer to the universities in Scotland. And so you get that interesting mix of perspectives there as well. So two other things about the kind of programme that, have been striking to me, looking back on it. One is those common elements around research and education, knowledge exchange, you know, and the kind of technology and, transformation programs that we've talked about before. But there's the kind of two big things from a, you know, both the UK and a European perspective. One is Brexit and the other is the COVID experience. So we lost a year, I think, because of COVID. So we had a 1 year break. But those two things, you know, from my point of view, Brexit in particular, meant that it had a new urgency to maintain that collaboration with Sweden when all other European links were going to pot.
Absolutely spot on. And I think this links to another really important point that is a characteristic of success, is that it's because it's a joint seminar that's in Jordan and works, it's a sort of training ground and a kind of manifestation of successful international collaborations, that you can take all these issues that we've learnt from how this has been organised successfully and apply them to other partnerships. Certainly that's, I can see that in other things. And you're absolutely right, Brexit and the need for deepening, therefore, some of these linkages with European institutions, of which this is one example of a network, is absolutely spot on.
The political dimensions to everything as well. I mean, we mentioned closeness to government, but I mean, the political environments in Sweden, you know, look to us to have been more stable than they have been in the UK. But actually, from a Swedish perspective, of course, they feel that they've had quite a lot of change after a very long period of, you know, stability under the Social Democrats. It kind of moved away. And so the challenges they've had around, particularly in relation to international student recruitment and, you know, the kind of hostility to immigration, you know, actually are surprisingly similar to some of the challenges we faced in the UK, although on the surface they look very different.
Completely right. Yeah. And in fact, I was just reminding myself of some of the issues that came out of the presentation from Swedish colleagues at the most recent conference, which you might not have heard from Swedish colleagues 10, 20 years ago, what they call responsible internationalization and how you manage that, but also the linkage with domestic politics, which, of course, we see here with, you know, international students and how they're considered as part of the immigration debate. The whole issue of security, now particularly important, of course, for the Swedes latterly because of their proximity to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that's very much on their minds. But actually, we know in the UK that there's been pressure from the government worried about international security issues and, you know, state actors getting hold of IP in UK universities and that sort of thing. But the Swedish universities as well are going through that dialogue with their new government. And in fact, I think that, did they not say that because they're part of the state, actually, the Swedish government have a say in who is on their governing boards?
Absolutely.
And in fact, point their vice chancellors, which is, you know, different from the UK universities, which are independent from the state. Imagine that. And and one of the things they've therefore required with this drive for security is that one of the members of the governing boards has to have an expertise or a brief for security, which is an interesting phenomenon. The way it's manifested itself there compared with the, you know, our worries about export controls and and the kind of work we do internationally in research with you know, different parts of the world. So that was interesting. And the other big one, of course, was when none of us are immune from global events, you know, the terrible events in the Middle East and so forth, which then we see demonstrations on campus and activism, and again that's happened in the Swedish context as it's happened in the UK context. So that's interesting. The one point of difference I still think is that because they're a part of the state system, they're very, very well funded still, they'll admit that, although I think they're coming under increasing scrutiny from the government on, you know, value for money issues and so forth. But that it is the case. Whereas, of course, at the moment in the UK, we face some huge financial pressures and funding pressures in universities. And so that's an interesting point of contrast and comparison, isn't it?
The issue of research funding in particular is a very distinct one in Sweden. They often say that they've got far more research income than they could possibly spend, and
I mean
it just seems utterly astounding to UK colleagues when yeah. you hear that kind of thing. The other areas that I've found absolutely fascinating and learning from Sweden, one was about the way in which students were involved, particularly in governance in yeah. Swedish universities. And again, this comes, I think, from a kind of government directive point of view. So yeah. It's common for, the equivalent, the student union president and one or two of their sidekicks to meet with the vice chancellor or equivalent every week.
Yeah.
So, and the vice chancellor then has to tell them what decisions they're intending to take that week
yeah.
in order to make sure that the students aren't upset with it, it's extraordinary in a UK context to think of that, but actually it's a really, really interesting approach to genuinely involving students as partners in governance in a way that we can't really dream of. But it seems it's commonplace in Swedish universities to have that kind of engagement.
Really interesting, isn't it? And I think some universities, some of the older universities in Sweden, still have constitutionally every week there's a sort of formal sitting down and signing off yep. of formal documents, isn't yep. there, in the presence yep. of students and so on, although that might be changing. The other thing I've always been fascinated to hear about is Swedish universities don't own their own estate or buildings. They are yeah. owned by I think they're called University Housing, which is like a government property company.
Akademika Hus, I think it is. Yeah,
that's it. Academic Housing. And I think there are one or two exceptions where they do own their own buildings, but the bigger facilities are owned by the government. So it's a completely different dynamic from our perspective as sort of university registrar COOs, because it's not about designing and raising the funding and delivering your own buildings and managing your own estate. Is actually more of a contractual relationship, trying to debate with this government agency about what facilities you need and then what contract you're going to have to lease the buildings and managing the rentals and that sort of thing. It's an interestingly different dynamic.
It is very different, and I mean, I can remember just being completely astounded when I heard that, and I couldn't quite believe it was true, but it is absolutely true. Yeah, they don't own most of their, and so they're engaged in an entirely different kind of debate when they're looking yeah. to build a new building or refurbish an existing one. It's a very different setup, but they still end up with the same challenges, which is yeah. Having buildings that aren't fit for purpose, need yes. refurbishment, and having to prioritise. So it's the
challenges
same issue,
with the use of space. That I yeah. mean, that was another big topic for yeah. them, isn't it? How many yeah. are in an office, all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Going back to the student, the other thing that stuck with me on students, one of the visits, and I think it was to I think it was Gothenburg, I can't remember, one of the Swedish universities. And this is common in lots of Swedish universities, I think. They don't so much have a single students' union, they have yeah. a series of students'
several.
Unions based in their own buildings or rented buildings or whatever they might be. But they, where they, so they're akin to a hall of residence, but with an actual students' union organisation. I can remember we dined in one evening and all the students sang to us at the beginning of
yeah.
the meal. It was fantastic.
That's right.
Absolutely
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah,
I felt slightly guilty that they were waiting on us, mind you, but they were getting paid for it, I think.
So they were getting paid for it, yeah. One of the benefits of the partnership is that you can establish institutional relationships with your counterparts in Sweden and then, yeah. Arrange for study visits either way. And at Birmingham, we did that for a number of years with the Stockholm University
yeah.
and KTH. And a few years ago, we had people go over and visit and vice versa. And that was really, really helpful. And I remember... this was well over 10 years ago now, sort of going and looking around their approach to central student facilities and both the points of comparison and difference. And they were, you should imagine, high quality, tech enabled even then, But of course, their student population is different. Their undergraduate population has some differences in that, you know, a larger number of part-time students. Students take much longer to complete their degrees. That is commonplace, isn't it, in continental Europe? The time to degree is much longer. The completion rates are lower, and it's less of an issue with people dropping out and coming back in. So the nature of these facilities, on the one hand, was familiar, but on the other hand, you know, they had to cope with a slightly different. A different pattern of student engagement.
Absolutely. Part of the fascination of it as well, so I mean, comes from, you know, going on a few visits as well. And I remember as part of the trip to Gothenburg, we were offered the opportunity to witness the installation of the new vice chancellor of Gothenburg University. Yes. And I think it was only myself and John Hogan, who was then registrar at Newcastle, decided to go. So it was really interesting. Of course, it was done entirely in Swedish, and so we had no real idea what was going on. But it was absolutely fascinating. And the thing that stuck in my mind was that there was the new vice chancellor was up on the stage. There were four or five people there saying how marvellous she was and how great her achievement was and whatever. And one of her predecessors was one of the people who was then had moved into government, was also making an oration. And she made a joke, which was clearly related to the discipline of study of the new vice chancellor, and of course the entire audience howled with laughter, with one exception. The new vice chancellor was not remotely amused by this guy, but it was a lovely experience, you know, because everyone had their swords on and their hats and their fine gown. Oh, it was brilliant. Great to see.
Brilliant. Maybe we've lost, other than in, you know, one or two ancient universities, some of those ceremonial aspects. They, you know, having said that about their sort of, you know, these deep historical roots, because some of these universities in Sweden are very old, aren't they? Places like Uppsala and London and so on. There's a huge sort of cutting edge modernity to it. And you mentioned going to see some of their facilities. I mean, I was struck by when we went to see the Max IV Synchrotron at Lund, you know, which is not just a Swedish facility, it's a pan-European facility used by researchers across the Europe. And, you know, it's a massive, you know, a hugely impressive site. And while we were there last, we were talking to some colleagues who are from the Swedish universities up in the north of Sweden near the Arctic Circle, and they're involved in a massive project to build, certainly Sweden, I think possibly Europe's biggest green steel factory, which is the size of a small town with thousands and thousands of workers. And the, you know, the university is heavily involved in, you know, the R&D and support of that. So, you know, some of these modern R&D complexes and research facilities that they have associated with the universities in Sweden are, you know, are very, very impressive by any international standards.
And without wishing to kind of trivialise this again, of course, the thing about Sweden is it's a very long country, and a big chunk of it is above the Arctic Circle, and of course that creates organisational complexities within the organisation of Swedish higher education. So one of those universities right up in the north is Luleå University, and they've got snow most of the blooming year, I think. So it's a very different student and staff experience in an institution like that, and it's a pain for them to get down to Stockholm for these big meetings, and I think there's now a prescription on them, you know, not traveling by plane these days, you know, and they've all got to get a train, and I imagine it just takes ages to get from one end of the country. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not great in the UK if you're coming from Aberdeen to London, I guess, but you know, I think it's pretty challenging for the sector in the country because of the distribution,
and we often remark on that when we go to some of these remote places, and the colleagues from the south of Sweden said, yeah, well, me too, I haven't been here for a long time either, you know.
I know one of the things we mentioned, the witnessing the installation of the VC. I mean, we've had nice trips out to historic castles and boat trips. And when we hosted the conference at Nottingham back in, I think 2015 it was, yeah, 2015, something like that. We got to go up the Trent Building clock tower and onto the roof of the Trent Building, which I'd never done before, and I was so pleased to have an excuse to be able to twist the arm of my security colleagues to allow us to do it, because it was a bit precarious, but it was such a great thing to do. But these excursions have been really, really a really nice part of the event as well.
They have. Do you remember the one? I think it was actually in Gothenburg, when we went out to that, what we thought was a sort of old church, a sort of old Swedish church, beautiful, beautiful church, for a sort of tweet, you know, for a crayfish meal. And it ended up being owned by one of the members of staff, didn't it?
Indeed. He was the chief of staff to the vice chancellor, I think, at the
right.
time.
Who very, very generously turned over his home for the event, and that was super. That was a lovely occasion, you know. I mean, at some point, Paul, we've got to get on to talking about the socials around all of this.
Let's do it now.
Me just finish off on a serious point before we do. You know, despite these points of difference and similarity, and if you like the quirkiness that comes into all higher education systems, ours or theirs, based on history and so forth, they are a very good system by any measure, aren't they? I mean, you know, they're, what is the country, 10 plus million population, and I think they've got three top 100 universities in Karolinska, which is, you know, always around the top 50, KTH, very strong, Lund, and usually Uppsala there or thereabouts, you know, and various others, you know. I think I remember seeing a number of international reports, OECD reports, and one that I think was produced by Australian universities looking at different HE systems. And the Swedish system always comes out pretty highly or very highly on both inputs and outputs, particularly for its size.
Yeah, I know. I think that's absolutely right. And it just goes to show that, you know, with different, very different models, you can achieve really, really good outcomes. And,
yes.
And I think that the kind of size and kind of coherence of their sector is really impressive as well. But you're absolutely right. And to your earlier point, there is this really long history. I mean, they've got, you know, some of these universities go back, you know, 500 years or so, and they are really, really impressive and well established. And they've had this tradition of stability as well, which I think, you know, is something that, you know, looking in it from outside, you kind of crave sometimes, you know, that kind of sense of stability.
Yeah, I agree with that. And probably have not. Well, they've latterly felt it in under the current Swedish government and the concerns in Sweden around, as you say, immigration, those sorts of issues. They've not been in the firing line in the way that UK universities have in the sort of culture wars.
Although they've had a little bit of it, but
they've had some of it, but it's not been as intense as it was for us in recent times.
The one other thing, I mean, we mentioned things that we learned that we were surprised about earlier, and one thing that I did mean to mention was the discovery that they had a single national student record system in higher education, LADOC, which I was completely gobsmacked to discover that. And, you know, genuinely amazed, because you think of all the challenges UK universities have had over the years with student records and the ongoing challenges with HESA and data futures. And, you know, they've just not had that. They had the initial pain of introducing it. And of course, there's a low level of unhappiness about it because it doesn't suit, you know, any university, but it does the job for everyone. And actually, it's a, you know, it saved the sector in Sweden a fortune over the past 20 or so years.
And it's a brilliant example of a shared service, isn't it? We often sort of, you know, all the debate at the moment about efficiency and effectiveness and back office costs and shared services and so on. Well, actually, we've got one or two good examples of that in the UK, if you think of, you know, UCAS and JISC and so forth. But actually, wouldn't it be amazing to have a shared student record system on a number of levels? First of all, it massively facilitates, you know, policies around student transferability, credit transfer and moving around, you know, back to some of our discussions about Swedish system. as you say, the collective purchasing power of the university is to influence change, whereas we're all dealing individually with the different suppliers trying to get change and customize it and so on. And I seem to remember that there was a brilliant essay written recently about this by an anonymous source, suggesting that the UK or certainly English universities should get together and do this.
Absolutely. And I think it's still available on the Higher Education Policy Institute website. So I will provide a link to that in the in the podcast notes, Lee. But thank you. Thank you for remembering that. That's greatly appreciated.
So what about ABBA?
What about ABBA? So, well, I can, again, going back to 2011, our first outing in Cardiff, I can remember, you know, pitching up for the dinner and being told in advance, you do realise there will be singing. And not really believing that it would actually involve me. I mean, my experience, I have never been a good singer. I appeared in musicals as a very bad singer. God knows how I got the parts, but I've never particularly enjoyed it. But it filled me with horror, I must admit, the idea of joining in. But it was one of those, it's a great leveller. And it was it's a really important part of Swedish culture that we were bound to embrace.
Great stuff, isn't it? So every year, for anyone listening to this, what happens is that the UK side gets together and supposedly has to rehearse its singing efforts as a collective, as a band, and then goes up against the Swedish one in a sort of sing-off over a series of rounds. And sometimes this is, you know, judged independently, and sometimes it's so obvious who's won. We lost the last round, didn't we? And the last one,
it was pretty poor in Southampton.
We were in fact, what I have got here, no one podcast won't be able to see it, but this is the UK Swedish Registrar's ABBA Songbook 2024 with the amazing four on the front there. I think they're real, not the virtual reality versions of them. But and you know, it includes everything: Dancing Queen on the first place, Knowing Me, Knowing You, Mamma Mia, The Winner Takes It All, and of course Waterloo.
And I mean, it's fair to say it wasn't always ABBA. We've done a range of traditional songs as well as ABBA songs. And indeed, in one case, Rachel Sambi-Thomas from Warwick University penned her own version of various songs. So it has been, a different event over the years, and sometimes better but usually worse, and the Swedes usually win because they're just better at it. It's fair to say,
and really get into the spirit of it all. It's, as you say, they love it as part of a kind of social event. And I suppose long dark winters, all that sort of stuff.
indeed. Well, listen, Lee, we better wrap it up there. But I mean, that's been a really, a bit of a nostalgia fest, if I'm honest. But actually, I think a really good reminder of the value of something that has been going for 40 odd years now. And it's a real signal success story in terms of international university collaboration in a way that, as you said at the beginning, some other collaborations really haven't lasted anywhere near as long, and for a whole range of reasons this one has been really successful.
Thanks Paul. Now I've enjoyed it. It's I hope, as well as the slightly more whimsical and, as you say, nostalgic elements to it, there are some important points in this, I think.
Well, let's hope it goes from success to success for many more generations in future, and we continue to learn a lot from our Swedish counterparts. But Indeed. Thank you very much, Lee.
No, thank you, Paul. All the best. See you soon.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with university registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.